Section 2 of A Short and Easy Method of Prayer. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Jordan. A Short Method of Prayer by Madame Guyon. Translated by A.W. Marston. Chapters 3 to 10.
Chapter 3. Second Degree of Prayer. Called here the Prayer of Simplicity. The second degree has been variously termed contemplation, the prayer of silence and of repose, while others again have called it the prayer of simplicity, and it is of this last term that I shall make use here, being more appropriate than that of contemplation, which signifies a degree of prayer more advanced than that of which I speak. After a time, as I have said, the soul becomes sensible of a facility in recognizing the presence of God. It collects itself more easily. Prayer becomes natural and pleasant. It knows that it leads to God, and it perceives the smell of his perfumes. Then it must change its method, and observe carefully what I am about to say, without being astonished at its apparent implausibility. First of all, when you bring yourself into the presence of God by faith, remain a short time in an attitude of respectful silence. If from the beginning, in making this act of faith, you are sensible of a little taste of the presence of God, remain as you are without troubling yourself on any subject, and keep that which has been given to you, so long as it may remain. If it leaves you, excite your will by means of some tender affection, and if you then find that your former state of peace has returned, remain in it. The fire must be blown softly, and as soon as it is lighted, cease to blow it, or you will put it out. It is also necessary that you should go to God, not so much to obtain something from him, as to please him and to do his will. For a servant who only serves his master in proportion to the recompense he receives, is unworthy of any remuneration. Go then to prayer, not only to enjoy God, but to be as he wills. This will keep you equal in times of barrenness and in times of abundance, and you will not be dismayed at the repulses of God, nor by his apparent indifference. Chapter 4. On Spiritual Dryness. As God's only desire is to give himself to the loving soul who desires to seek him, he often hides himself in order to arouse it and compel it to seek him with love and fidelity. But how does he reward the faithfulness of his beloved? And how are his apparent flights followed by loving caresses? The soul imagines that it is a proof of its fidelity and of its increased love that it seeks God with an effort, or that at least such seeking will soon lead to his return. But no, this is not the way in this degree. With a loving impatience, with deep humility and abasement, with an affection deep and yet restful, with a respectful silence, you must await the return of your beloved. You will thus show him that it is himself alone that you love, and his good pleasure, and not the pleasure that you find in loving him. Therefore it is said, "Make not haste in time of trouble. Cleave unto him, and depart not away, that thou mayest be increased at thy last end." Suffer the suspensions and the delays of the visible consolations of God. Be patient in prayer, even though you should do nothing all your life, but wait in patience, with a heart humbled, abandoned, resigned, and content for the return of your beloved. Oh, excellent prayer! How it moves the heart of God, and obliges him to return more than anything else. Chapter 5. Abandonment to God, its fruit and its irrevocability, in what it consists. God exhorts us to it. It is here that true abandonment and consecration to God should commence, by our being deeply convinced that all which happens to us moment by moment, is the will of God, and therefore all that is necessary to us. This conviction will render us contented with everything, and will make us see the commonest events in God, and not in the creature. I beg of you, whoever you may be, who are desirous of giving yourselves to God, not to take yourselves back when once you are given to Him, and to remember that a thing once given away is no longer at your disposal. Abandonment is the key to the inner life. He who is thoroughly abandoned will soon be perfect. You must, then, hold firmly to your abandonment without listening to reason or to reflection. A great faith makes a great abandonment. You must trust wholly in God, against hope believing in hope. Abandonment is the casting off of all care of ourselves, to leave ourselves to be guided entirely by God. All Christians are exhorted to abandonment, for it is said to all, "Take no thought for the morrow, for your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. Commit thy works unto the Lord, and thy thoughts shall be established. Commit thy way unto the Lord, trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass." Abandonment, then, ought to be an utter leaving of ourselves, both outwardly and inwardly, in the hands of God, forgetting ourselves and thinking only of God. By this means the heart is kept always free and contented. Practically, it should be a continual loss of our own will in the will of God, a renunciation of all natural inclinations, however good they may appear, in order that we may be left free to choose only as God chooses. We should be indifferent to all things, whether temporal or spiritual, for the body or the soul, having the past in forgetfulness, the future to providence, and giving the present to God, contented with the present moment, which brings with it God's eternal will for us, attributing nothing which happens to us to the creature, but seeing all things in God, and regarding them as coming infallibly from His hand, with the exception only of our own sin. Leave yourselves, then, to be guided by God as He will, whether as regards the inner or the outward life. Chapter 6. Of Suffering, which must be accepted as from God, its fruits. Be content with all the suffering that God may lay upon you. If you will love Him purely, you will be as willing to follow Him to Calvary as to Tabor. He must be loved as much on Calvary as on Tabor, since it is there that He makes the greatest manifestation of His love. Do not act, then, like those people who give themselves at one time and hold themselves back at another. They give themselves to be caressed and take themselves back when they are crucified, or else they seek for consolation in the creature. You can only find consolation in the love of the cross and in complete abandonment. He who has no love for the cross has no love for God. It is impossible to love God without loving the cross, and a heart which has learned to love the cross finds sweetness, joy, and pleasure, even in the bitterest things. To the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet, because it is as hungry for the cross as it is hungry for God. The cross gives God, and God gives the cross. Abandonment and the cross go together. As soon as you are sensible that something is repugnant to you, which presents itself to you in the light of suffering, abandon yourself at once to God for that very thing, and present yourself as a sacrifice to Him, and you will see that when the cross comes, it will have lost much of its weight, because you will desire it. This will not prevent your being sensible of its weight. Some people imagine that it is not suffering to feel the cross. The feeling of suffering is one of the principal parts of suffering itself. Jesus himself was willing to suffer in its intensity. Often the cross is borne with weakness, at other times with strength. All should be equal in the will of God. Chapter 7. On Mysteries. God gives them here in reality. It will be objected that by this way mysteries will not be made known. It is just the contrary. They are given to the soul in reality. Jesus Christ, to whom it is abandoned, and whom it follows as the way, whom it hears as the truth, and who animates it as the life, impressing himself upon it, imparts to it his own condition. To bear the conditions of Christ is something far greater than merely to consider those conditions. Paul bore the conditions of Christ on his body. "I bear in my body," he says, "the marks of the Lord Jesus." But he does not say that he reasoned about them. Often Christ gives in this state of abandonment views of his conditions in a striking manner. We must receive equally all the dispositions in which he may be pleased to place us, choosing for ourselves to abide near to him and to be annihilated before him, but receiving equally all that he gives us, light or darkness, facility or barrenness, strength or weakness, sweetness or bitterness, temptations or distractions, sorrow, care, uncertainty, none of these things ought to move us. There are some persons to whom God is continually revealing his mysteries. Let them be faithful to them. But when God sees fit to remove them, let them suffer them to be taken. Others are troubled because no mysteries are made known to them. This is needless, since a loving attention to God includes all particular devotion, and that which is united to God alone, by its rest in him, is instructed in a most excellent manner in all mysteries. He who loves God loves all that is of him. Chapter 8. On Virtue. All virtues given with God in this degree of the prayer of the heart. This is the short and the sure way of acquiring virtue, because God, being the principle of all virtue, we possess all virtue in possessing God. More than this, I say that all virtue which is not given inwardly is a mask of virtue, and like a garment that can be taken off and will wear out. But virtue, communicated fundamentally, is essential, true, and permanent. The King's daughter is all glorious within. And there are none who practice virtue more constantly than those who acquire it in this way, though virtue is not a distinct subject of their thought. How hungry these loving ones are after suffering! They think only of what can please their beloved, and they begin to neglect themselves and to think less of themselves. The more they love God, the more they hate themselves. Oh, if all could learn this method, so easy that it is suited for all, for the most ignorant as for the most learned, how easily the whole church would be reformed! You only need to love. St. Augustine says, "Love and do as you please, for when we love perfectly, we shall not desire to do anything that could be displeasing to our beloved." Chapter 9. Of Perfect Conversion, which is an effect of this method of prayer. Two of its aids: the attraction of God and the central inclination of the soul. "Turn ye unto him from whom the children of Israel have deeply revolted." Conversion is nothing else but a turning from the creature to God. conversion is not perfect, though it is necessary for salvation, when it is merely a turning from sin to grace. To be complete, it must be a turning from without to within. The soul, being turned in the direction of God, has a great facility for remaining converted to Him. The longer it is converted, the nearer it approaches to God and attaches itself to Him, and the nearer it approaches to God, the more it becomes necessarily drawn from the creature which is opposed to God. But this cannot be done by a violent effort of the creature. All that it can do is to remain turned in the direction of God in a perpetual adherence. God has an attracting virtue, which draws the soul more strongly towards Himself, and in attracting it, He purifies it, as we see the sun attracting a dense vapour, and gradually, without any other effort on the part of the vapour than that of letting itself be drawn, the sun, by bringing it near to Himself, refines and purifies it. There is, however, this difference, that the vapour is not drawn freely and does not follow willingly, as is the case with the soul. This manner of turning within is very simple and makes the soul advance naturally and without effort, because God is its centre. The centre has always a strong attractive power, and the larger the centre, the stronger is its attractive force. Besides this attraction of the centre, there is given to all natural objects a strong tendency to become united with their centre. As soon as anything is turned in the direction of its centre, unless it be stopped by some invincible obstacle, it rushes towards it with extreme velocity. A stone in the air is no sooner let loose and turned towards the earth, then it tends to it by its own weight as its centre. It is the same with fire and water, which being no longer arrested, run incessantly towards their centre. Now I say that the soul, by the effort it has made in inward recollection, being turned towards its centre, without any other effort but simply by the weight of love, falls towards its centre, and the more it remains quiet and at rest, making no movement of its own, the more rapidly it will advance, because it thus allows that attractive virtue to draw it. All the care, then, that we have is to promote this inward recollection as much as possible, not being astonished at the difficulty we may find in this exercise, which will soon be recompensed with a wonderful cooperation on the part of God, which will render it very easy. When the passions rise, a look towards God, who is present within us, easily deadens them. Any other resistance would irritate rather than appease them. Chapter 10. Higher degree of prayer, which is that of the simple presence of God, or active contemplation. The soul, faithfully exercising itself in the affection and love of its God, is astonished to find Him taking complete possession of it. His presence becomes so natural that it would be impossible not to have it. It becomes habitual to the soul, which is also conscious of a great calm spreading over it. Its prayer is all silence, and God imparts to it an intrinsic love, which is the commencement of ineffable happiness. Oh, if I could describe the infinite degrees which follow! But I must stop here, since I am writing for beginners, and wait till God shall have to light what may be useful to those more advanced. I can only say that at this point it is most important that all natural operation should cease, that God may act alone. "Be still and know that I am God," is His own word by David. But man is so attached to his own works that he cannot believe God is working unless he can feel, know, and distinguish His operation. he does not see that it is the speed of his course which prevents his seeing the extent of his advancement, and that the operation of God, becoming more abundant, absorbs that of the creature. As we see that the sun, in proportion as he rises, absorbs the light of the stars, which were easily distinguishable before he appeared. It is not the want of light, but an excess of light, which prevents our distinguishing the stars. It is the same here. Man can no longer distinguish his own operation, because the strong light absorbs all his little distinct lights, and makes them fade away entirely, because God's excess surpasses them all. So that those who accuse this degree of prayer of being a state of idleness are greatly deceived, and only speak thus from want of experience. Oh, if they would only prove it! In how short a time they would become experimentally acquainted with this matter! I say then that this failure of work does not spring from scarcity, but from abundance. Two classes of persons are silent: the one because they have nothing to say, the other because they have too much. It is thus in this degree: we are silent from excess, not from want. Water causes death to two persons in very different ways. One dies of thirst, another is drowned. The one dies from want, the other from abundance. So here it is abundance which causes the cessation of natural operation. It is therefore important in this degree to remain as much as possible in stillness. At the commencement of this prayer, a movement of affection is necessary, but when grace begins to flow into us, we have nothing to do but to remain at rest and take all that God gives. Any other movement would prevent our profiting by this grace, which is given in order to draw us into the rest of love. The soul, in this peaceful attitude of prayer, falls into a mystic sleep, in which all its natural powers are silenced, until that which had been temporary becomes its permanent condition. You see that the soul is thus led, without effort, without study, without artifice. The heart is not a fortified place, which must be taken by cannonading and violence. It is a kingdom of peace, which is possessed by love. Gently following in his train, you will soon reach the degree of intuitive prayer. God asks nothing extraordinary and difficult. On the contrary, he is most pleased with childlike simplicity. The grandest part of religion is the most simple. It is the same with natural things. Do you wish to get to the sea? Embark upon a river, and insensibly and without effort you will be taken to it. Do you wish to get to God? Take his way, so quiet, so easy, and in a little while you will be taken to him in a manner that will surprise you. Oh, if only you would try it! How soon you would see that I am telling you only too little, and that the experience would far surpass any description that could be given. What do you fear? Why do you not throw yourself at once into the arms of love, who only stretched them out upon the cross in order to take you in? What risk can there be in trusting God and abandoning yourself to him? Oh, he will not deceive you, unless it be by giving you far more than you ever expected, while those who expect everything from themselves may well take to themselves the reproach which God utters by the mouth of Isaiah: "Thou art wearied in the greatness of thy way, yet saidst thou not, There is no hope."
End of section 2.